atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. My guest today is Alan Gelzel, the Thomas W. Smith Distinguished Research Scholar in the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. He's a three-time winner of the Lincoln Prize, awarded annually for the finest scholarly work in English on Abraham Lincoln, the American Civil War soldier, or a subject relating to their era. Honestly, if there's anyone who knows more about Lincoln than Professor Gelzel, I have no idea who it would be, and so I am very pleased to be able to talk with him today about his latest book, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. Professor Gelzel, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
I tend to start with titles because I think the titles are there for a reason. They tend to say something about the book. And so let's talk about your title. Why Our Ancient Faith?
It's a phrase Lincoln uses. And he uses it in a great speech that he gives in Peoria, Illinois, on October 16, 1854. I think it's one of his greatest speeches. And I think that it's safe to say that even if everything Lincoln said on the subject of politics was somehow mysteriously erased, leaving only the October 1854 Peoria speech, we would still have all of Lincoln's political philosophy in this one place. It's that extraordinary a speech. And in that speech, he speaks about the Declaration of Independence. He speaks about the principles on which American democracy are built. And he speaks of them as our ancient faith. Now, it's a curious choice of terms because it sounds like he's almost talking about religion. And yet, what he wants us to do is to think about the principles of the Declaration and the democracy that springs from them as things that you would hold on to with all the tenacity of a religious faith, with all the emotion, with all the insight, with all the doubts and all the anxieties and fears, and yet with also the certainties that go along with that. Lincoln would like us to think of observance of the principles of democracy as a faith. And he even speaks of it as ancient. Now, of course, he's talking about a document that only goes back to 1776. But for him, that's long enough. That's long enough in the life of a political system to qualify as ancient. And he especially wants to paint around the idea of the Declaration of Independence, the authority of ancientness. So he will call the principles of the Declaration our ancient faith. And it's from that that I take the title for the book.
And at one point, I don't know if it was that particular speech, but at one point Lincoln said that nothing could be, in his words, as clearly true as the truth of democracy. What does he mean by that, the truth of democracy?
He means that if you examine the way the universe is put together and human beings in it, there are certain natural laws that govern human existence and the existence of everything. And for him, that could begin with physics. I mean, physics describes laws that govern the way the universe operates. The universe doesn't operate by accident. It operates by physical law. And physical law that can be measured, that can be predicted. Well, from that, people in Lincoln's day said, if law governs the physics of the universe and the physical aspects of the universe, can we also discern the same operation of law in human nature? Is there a natural law that, as a counterpart, as an analogy to physical law, a natural law that governs human behavior? Jefferson certainly thought so, because Jefferson talks about how everyone comes hardwired with certain natural rights, rights to life, to liberty, to the pursuit of happiness. And those natural rights are simply there in everybody and in the same quantities in everybody. In fact, they're so hardwired into us that they are, as Jefferson puts it, inalienable. You you can't get rid of them even if you wanted to. You could put them up for sale, but you can't do that. You have those rights. That's part of the natural law that governs human existence. Now, that being the case, if you understand how law operates in the physical universe, if you understand how law operates in the natural world and the world of human nature, then you will see that democracy is the political system that best permits the functioning of those kinds of natural laws that govern human existence. Because if you're going to talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness being something that everyone is born with, well, what is going to be the best way for you to exercise those natural rights? Certainly, it's not going to be through monarchy, because in a monarchy, certain people have more rights. They have more access. They have more happiness that they can enjoy. And they believe that they are entitled to that by means of the accident of birth. And Lincoln says, no, no, no. There are no accidents in birth. Everyone comes into this world equipped with the same rights and in the same quantity. That means that monarchy is not a natural form of government. And the proof is in the pudding, because how do monarchs maintain their authority? They do it by the imposition of power, not by the consent of the people themselves. Monarchs don't ask people for their opinion about policies that are going to be implemented. The monarchs simply dictate them. And that's as true for ordinary run-of-the-mill military dictators as it is for those who are the offspring of generations of kings and queens. Now, those are kinds of governments that impose by means of power and authority. If you understand human beings as being those who possess these natural rights, then you understand that the best regime, the best system for allowing those natural rights to flourish is democracy. Because democracy respects those natural rights. Democracy is, in fact, founded on those natural rights. So Lincoln will conclude, yes, it is the most natural system of government that could possibly be on offer.
And so in that sense, he would probably disagree with, say, that famous Churchill quote, right? Democracy, the worst form of government, except for all those others that have been tried from time to time. For him, his great faith in democracy is because of that, a part and parcel of that naturalness then. It's not just a better system than other things, but fitting in a deep and fundamental way.
Well, Churchill was, after all, speaking from the middle of a monarchy of sorts, a constitutional monarchy, granted, but still a monarchy which, even in Churchill's day, was governed to a tremendous degree by inherited privilege. And also, Churchill was poking a little bit of fun at all these other systems, the other systems which affect to look down their noses at democracy and say, democracy. Oh, that's for the unwashed millions. And Churchill's comment is a way of saying, yeah, it is. It is a form of government for those unwashed millions. Yeah, it just happens to be better than anything else that you aristocrats have come up with, unwashed or not.
But Lincoln's understanding of democracy, it seems to me, we're talking about in a theoretical sense, but when you get into the nuts and bolts, it seems to me there are certain things that, at least at the time, it didn't include, people it didn't include. And so how did he sort of conceptualize it, feeling like he was being true to that soaring rhetoric, and yet there's this reality where women and blacks and a lot of other people really didn't seem in practice to have those self-evident natural rights?
And Lincoln acknowledged that. He did not claim that the American democracy was the perfect realization of the ideals of democracy. What he said was that Jefferson, in writing the Declaration of Independence, laid down the axioms of a free society. When he uses the word axioms, the first thing that springs to mind is geometry, or at least it springs to my mind, having had a remarkably good time in 10th grade geometry a long time. I'm afraid I'm not a math person, but geometry I loved. And I loved particularly, I think, because it was all about logical relations. Well, What he says about Jefferson is that Jefferson, in the Declaration of Independence, is laying out the axioms of a free society. Now, in geometry, it's what you do with those axioms that makes things different, that makes you have the right conclusion or the wrong conclusion. And in a sense, the axioms that we have and that Lincoln had in his hand are only the place that you begin. That's where geometry has its start, with the axioms. After that, it's up to us to work out the logic of that geometrical system, to work out the implications of those axioms. And Lincoln once compared it this way to a reference to the Gospels. He said, you can read in the New Testament this injunction, be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Not, Lincoln said, that you're going to achieve perfection now or even tomorrow, but rather that you're going to aspire to it. So a democracy, especially at an early stage of its life, may in fact make some mistakes. It may take some wrong turns. It may not include people it should include. Maybe it won't know to exclude some people it would be better off excluding. The Athenian democracy had this problem. Athens is, so to speak, in its golden age, the pilot project for democracy. And yet, in Athens, democracy in the age of Pericles is pretty well limited only to a certain number of adult males who were citizens of Athens itself. We might be talking about 3,000 to 6,000 people maximum. It did not include slaves. It did not include women. That, in fact, was one of the problems that Athenian democracy will eventually encounter. Because 200 years on from its first showing, they have to deal with the assault of the Macedonians. The Macedonians have great numbers. The Athenian democracy, unfortunately, has kept itself very limited. And in so doing, it can't really very easily draw on the loyalties of a lot of people to defend it. And so the Macedonians, by sheer numbers, overwhelmed the Greek city-states and Athens in particular. That was a mistake that the Athenian democracy made. The Roman Republic, to the extent that we consider that a democracy, Roman Republic makes something of the same error. The Roman Republic is wiser in extending more broadly its citizenship, first to all of Italy and then throughout its empire. Yet at the same time, it also circumscribes what those citizens can do. And what it means is that in the dying days of the Republic, people have become so frustrated that real decision-making, oh yes, citizenship is broadly construed and defined, but real decision-making is kept in the hands of a very small number of people. And what really brings down the Republic is the demagogic approach of leaders like Julius Caesar, who are promising to people to open up Roman society. And so Caesar is able to engineer the downfall of the Republic. Republics and democratic republics, they make mistakes. Lincoln understands this, and he is willing to have people make an appeal to him and say, perhaps we've made a mistake on this particular issue. Perhaps we should rethink this. And certainly that's true in terms of those who had been slaves. Because while at first, Lincoln's inclination is to suggest that perhaps when you free slaves, what you want to do is you would like to, quite frankly, deport them. This is the policy that was called colonization. And maybe the deportation would take place to Central America, perhaps the Caribbean, maybe West Africa. But still, the first instinct of a lot of people in talking about the abolition of slavery was to take a next step that would send all the freed slaves someplace else. Lincoln will listen to that at first. But then, given some time and some experiment, he rejects that. By 1864, he's starting to talk about the franchise for the newly freed slaves, for voting rights. And from voting rights, of course, everything that will proceed from there will include all other kinds of civil rights. And in the very last speech he gives, on the 11th of April, 1865, he talks very clearly about the extension of voting rights to a number of the freed slaves. So he is willing to not only talk about how democracy aspires to become more and more democratic, he's willing to take steps to make that happen. Aspiration. That doesn't mean that democracies don't make mistakes. But it does mean that democracies have the flexibility to do better, to, as he put it, to aspire to a kind of perfection that they might at that moment not possess.
And so then, so let's say the Lincoln of 1858, who said he had no interest in bringing about the social and political equality of white and black people, doesn't think black people should be jurors or voters or office holders or anything like that. Is it fair to say that by the end of his life, and not that many years later, he had essentially changed his views on this? Or I guess I'm trying to get a sense of how much of that was political positioning. There had to be some of that, I assume. How much was just practical politics, and how much was Lincoln as a theorist, a believer in democracy, actually changing in a fundamental way? Those things are probably intermingled in a way we can't separate, but if anyone can, maybe you can give us a sense of that.
I don't think he changes in the most fundamental basis. I think the Lincoln that we meet in the presidency is still very much the Lincoln who proposes in 1837 in the Illinois state legislature a resolution denouncing slavery as an example of injustice and bad policy. I think he has to work out the ramifications of that position, and he does through the rest of his life. But fundamentally, in his hostility to slavery, that never really changes in Lincoln's life. What he is looking to do is, how are the ways that we apply it? Someone who actually saw this very clearly was Stephen A. Douglas, ironically. Because he will hear in the great debates of 1858, Lincoln talk about how he's not in favor of extending certain civil rights, certain political rights. He nevertheless understands that Lincoln's opposition to slavery is based upon the Declaration of Independence. He understands that Lincoln is applying, as Douglas would not. Douglas very explicitly does not believe the Declaration of Independence applies to anybody apart from the descendants of British colonists. He understands that when Lincoln is talking about the propositions that all men are created equal and the other propositions of the Declaration about rights, he understands very clearly that Lincoln is on a path that is going to lead, long or short, to full equality. And he says that because if you want to have black people as voters, if you want to have black people as members of juries, if you want to have black people as people who are going to be able to occupy political office, well, you should go ahead and vote for Lincoln because that's where his ideas are going to lead us. And I have to say that for once in his life, Stephen Douglas was right. That was where the logic of aspiration was going to take Lincoln. Because that common foundation that you see all through Lincoln's career about the application of the Declaration of Independence's principles to everyone would lead him ineluctably, logically, to exactly those conclusions. You mentioned, by the way, votes for women. Now, what you find very early on is one statement from Lincoln where he talks about extending voting rights to women in Illinois, where he says as part of a platform, as he's running for the Illinois state legislature, he says he's in favor of everybody who pays taxes having the right to vote, including, he says, women. So if you own property, in other words, if you've got a stake in Illinois society, and it's a real measurable stake in Illinois life, you should have the right to vote. Now, at that moment, you want to wonder, well, does that mean that this would also extend to free black people in Illinois? And the conclusion you have to draw from what he says in that statement is, well, yes. Now, he doesn't repeat this about women voting at any other point later in his life, but it is interesting that for him, the logic of the Declaration of Independence will point in that direction. And someone like Stephen A. Douglas could see that was where Lincoln was going to go sooner or later.
And so Lincoln is a believer, is a great believer in this ancient faith, a believer in, well, in people, I guess, in a sense. But he also, as you discuss in the book, was somewhat suspicious of passion and how people can be motivated by passion and the problems that that can cause in a democracy. And in the book, you argue that at least Lincoln believed that what mitigated, as you call, the baleful tendencies of passion in democracy was law. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about Lincoln's suspicion of passion and how he saw law as at least potentially, hopefully, acting as a check on those passions.
We use the word passion today a lot as a positive term. We ask people, what's your passion? And what we mean by that is, what are you really interested in? What really gets you up in the morning and gets you to doing what you do? Lincoln didn't think of passion in anything quite so positive a way. And that's because in the 18th and the 19th century, passion itself was understood to be a very negative term. Passion is when people are carried away out of themselves, and not in a good sense. It's when people lose all sense of self-control, when raw emotion grabs hold of them and leads them to do things that in a calmer and more logical light, they would never dream of doing. It leads them, for instance, to become part of mobs. It is a movement that defies reason and logic. For Lincoln, democracy is a function of reason. Democracy is a reasonable system. After all, democracy is based on the idea that it's not who your parents were who make you what you are. It's who you, through your own effort, through your own talents, through your own ingenuity. It's what you make of yourself. So for Lincoln, the idea that someone should enjoy status in society really because of the accident of their birth, that's purely illogical. It doesn't behave according to any standard of reason. Likewise, when he looks around American society and he sees, as he did in the 1830s, mobs taking over parts of cities, mobs conducting lynchings, mobs behaving as though they had no restraint whatsoever. Mobs don't think. That's why they're mobs. And that appalled Lincoln. That, he said, is what you see as the operation of passion. Passion is the opposite of reason. Passion is the moment when you won't listen to reason, when you're carried away outside of yourself and out of control. That, he says, that's a dangerous moment for democracies. Democracies have to be regimes of reason. Dictatorships, especially the dictatorships of demagogues, even monarchies, are built upon honor, they're built upon passion, they're built upon conquest. They're built upon, let us say it, Henry V appealing to his band of brothers, whom he's never really going to treat as brothers, but nevertheless, band of brothers, that those this day who shed their blood with me shall be my brothers. And you think, that's a great speech, but he doesn't really mean it. And of course he didn't. He was a king. But it's a passionate speech, wonderful passionate speech. It just doesn't obey any kind of reason. Lincoln believed that democracy only functions by reason. A healthy democracy is a democracy which puts things together logically. And the way you express that, what captures the function of reason in a democracy, is law. Because law is logical. This is why Lincoln was such a good lawyer. He practices law for 24 years before the presidency. And he's a trial lawyer, and he's a very good one. Why? Because he could put A and B and C and D together in the right order and make you see, even if you didn't want to, what the connection of these things was. One observer of the Lincoln-Douglas debate said that if you listened to Stephen A. Douglas, you'd be carried away by his passion, by shaking his mane of black hair, by pumping his fists, by stamping his feet. Then Lincoln would get up in that high-pitched, accented voice of his. And he wouldn't shake his fist, and he wouldn't stamp his feet. Rather, this observer said, he would put out an idea, and the idea would be like a hook in your mouth. You would agree to that idea and the way he presented it, and then he would just reel you in. That was how Lincoln operated, and that, he believed, that was how a democracy really operates. Not by arousing people's hatreds, but rather by appealing to people's reason in order to move forward. So for him, passion is an ugly term. No matter the way we may use it today, passion is an ugly term. It is about people who have lost control over themselves. And in losing control over themselves, have lost control over their political destinies as well.
One way I think some people look at Lincoln, typically people who aren't, I would say, great admirers of him, is that he may have talked about his belief in law and his belief in these fundamental principles. But when push comes to shove during the Civil War, he throws at least some of that out the window. You know, a suspending habeas corpus would probably be the biggest example that comes to mind. And so in that, he actually was showing himself to be something of a hypocrite. And I'm wondering if first off, if you think that charge of hypocrisy is true or fair. And secondly, even if it is, if maybe it was justifiable in the context.
I'm not sure there's a yes or no one. And the reason that I say that I'm not sure is that, for one thing, Lincoln is dealing with an entirely novel situation in the Constitution and in law. And that is a civil war. A civil war waged over an issue that, in fact, doesn't appear in the Constitution at all, and that is secession. The Confederate States of America announced that they were seceding from the Union. Lincoln objects to this and says, show me where in the Constitution the provisions are that govern secession from the Union. There aren't any. And there's a reason for that, Lincoln wants us to understand. The reason for it is because the founders of the Republic did not believe that what they were creating was just a loose federation of independent entities. They were creating a more perfect union than the one that had prevailed before under the Articles of Confederation. That when you became part of the United States, this was a permanent arrangement. You were part of a union which, he insists, had actually existed even before the Declaration of Independence. So to be part of the union meant it was something indissolvable. And the proof is there's no provision in the Constitution for dissolving it. The Constitution contains a great deal, sometimes in great detail. The single largest provision in the Constitution is about electing a president, the Electoral College. And there, the detail is very much in order. But there's no description of a process of secession. There's no description even of what you do with the federal property in the places that have tried to secede from the Union. There's no reversion clause in the Constitution. And Lincoln says there's a reason for that. And that is because the founders did not contemplate the possibility of secession. Therefore, secession is unconstitutional. What it really is, it's a rebellion. And I, as president, am obligated by my oath, an oath to protect, preserve, and defend the Constitution, I am obligated to put down that rebellion the same way that Washington put down the Whiskey Rebellion in the 1790s, the same way that Andrew Jackson would have acted to put down rebellion in South Carolina during the nullification crisis in 1852. I am simply doing what the Constitution is obligating me to do. That's not unconstitutional. That's not an overriding of law. Now, that's the big issue. The subsidiary issue is, all right, let's grant that he has not only the authority, but the obligation to move forward and corral these attempted seceders. Did he do it the right way? Did he violate civil liberties in the process? And the answer to that question is yes, he did. So I've done no, now I'm going to do yes as part of the answer to your question. Because, again, as I said before, Lincoln doesn't have a template. He doesn't enter into the thing called civil war because the Constitution tells you how to conduct civil war. It doesn't. So he is in new territory. He's feeling his way through this. And you see him sometimes feeling his way through some of these problems. Here's a case, actually two cases, in 1863. One is the arrest of a prominent dissident named Clement Vallandigham in Ohio. Vallandigham had been a member of Congress, a Democrat, member of the opposition party to Lincoln's Republican Party. Very critical of the way the war was being carried on, very critical of Lincoln, very critical of the draft. He gives a speech in Mount Vernon, Ohio, criticizing all of the above. And at that point, the military commandant of that particular district has Vallandigham arrested. And he's tried before a military tribunal. And he's sentenced to imprisonment in Fort Warren in Boston Harbor. Now, how does Lincoln respond to this? Watch the ambiguity here. Lincoln, first of all, believes that Vallandigham has gotten everything he's been asking for. Vallandigham is a menace to the war effort, because what is Vallandigham really doing? He's encouraging people to desert, because he has said, you know, the Lincoln government is illegitimate. So Lincoln takes umbrage at that. He will support the arrest of Vallandigham. However, he also has a lot of blowback on this, politically speaking. A lot of people who say this is a terrible trampling on civil liberties. Now, he responds to that blowback with a long, reasoned argument that is sometimes called the Corning Letter in June of 1863, in which he explains the basis on which he's doing what he's doing with Vallandigham. But in the end, what does he actually do? Does he send Vallandigham to the dungeon in Fort Warren? No. What he does, curiously enough, is he says, Vallandigham seems to like the Confederacy so much. Let's send him there. So he sends Vallandigham through Union lines to the Confederate Army under a flag of truce, and he expels Vallandigham. So he doesn't imprison him. He does take him out of circulation. Vallandigham's not happy with this. He doesn't like being sent to the Confederates. The Confederates don't like him. He slips out of the Confederacy on a blockade runner and goes to Halifax. And from Canada, he actually tries to run for governor of Ohio. Fails. It's ignominious. And after several months, Vallandigham slips back into the United States. At that point, people come to Lincoln and say, should we arrest him again? And Lincoln says, no, don't. Not unless he does something really violent. Just let him go. And so he does. And Vallandigham continues to be a thorn in Lincoln's side. But Lincoln has at least learned this lesson. And that is, you can actually do your own cause more harm by violating those civil liberties than by letting the violator, in this case, Clement Vallandigham, the violator of the peace of Lincoln's administration, you can actually get more out of things by just letting him talk. Letting people listen and then letting them reject what he's got to say. That doesn't exactly sound like a terrible oppressive response. Another example, just to give you an idea of how he's trying to sort his way through this. The Chicago Times, a Democratic newspaper hostile to Lincoln, had been for years, is shut down by this same military commandant in the summer of 1863. Well, at that moment, that was just the wrong time to do that kind of thing. Prominent political figures, including many friends of Lincoln, go to him and say, you can't shut down a newspaper like that. And Lincoln then issues an order rescinding the shutdown. All right, he rescinds the shutdown, but then others come back to him and say, no, this man who's been editing the Chicago Times, he's made a complete nuisance of himself. And then Lincoln said, all right, well, we'll let the suspension stand. And it goes back and forth and back and forth. What's he doing? He's feeling his way around these particular problems. In the end, probably not more than 15,000 arrests were made during the war. And of those 15, and this is 15,000 out of a nation of 22 million people, 22 million people in the North. It's not exactly the night of the Long Knives. Within that 15,000, at least half were blockade runners. They were smugglers through the lines, I mean, people who were really committing what were borderline criminal offenses. Maybe somewhere between 300 and 500 were actual political arrests. No one is executed for this. And even those who are detained can usually, in almost every case, be released from detention if they're willing to take an oath of loyalty to the United States. So there are mistakes that are made, both in the actual suppression of civil liberties and interference with civil liberties. There are even problems that I find with Lincoln's justification in the Corning Letter for what he is doing about civil liberties. But are we looking at a catastrophe for civil liberties? Certainly not. What we're looking at are some real dents, and we're looking at some things that I think we should deplore. I think that mistakes that Lincoln made, but at the same time, bear in mind, once again, he has no template. He is feeling his way through this. He certainly is not doing the kinds of things we did during World War I. And there were some really outrageous violations of civil liberties. certainly we're not, we do not see in Lincoln the kinds of things that we see in the internment of Japanese Americans at the beginning of American involvement in World War II. There's nothing that even approaches what was done by that intern. So on the whole, when you look at Lincoln, you have to judge him in the context of what exactly are we talking about in terms of scope, and what exactly are we talking about in terms of the cases themselves. When we do that, yes, we have to admit, and I will admit, Lincoln makes mistakes. They're regrettable. He was wrong. He does not, however, commit what you would call a flagrant disregard of civil liberties. If anything, Lincoln said later, my administration will be judged for having not committed more violations of civil liberties during the Civil War.
One thing that strikes me in reading your book and the various other things I've read about Lincoln over the years is what seems to me like almost a willingness for him to think through issues and be very honest about the fact that he's thinking through them in a way that in modern political life seems to be almost extinct, and that if you tried to do the same thing, you'd be called walking something back or flip-flopping or something. And yet, time after time, I've come across Lincoln essentially saying, well, you know, I'm working this out, essentially. And I guess I'm wondering, it's obviously very unique for this day and age. Was it unique for his day and age as well at his level of politics?
Oh, I think it was, because it's always incumbent on the politician to look like they know better than to make a mistake. Lincoln, on the other hand, is willing to admit, we are in novel territory. I am working my way through things. When a very impatient group came to him demanding emancipation, he said, look, what I'm trying to do is a little bit like what was done by Blondine. Now, Blondine was a famous acrobat who had acquired fame by having a rope stretched across Niagara Falls and then crossing the falls on that rope like an acrobat, with a pole to balance left and right, left and right. Of course, every step Blondine took could mean life or death, and every step had to be taken extremely carefully. He said, I am like Blondine. Now, if you were giving advice to Blondine, would you be standing on the shore saying, Blondine, a little to the left, Blondine, a little to the right? No. You don't want to distract him. You'd be on your knees praying for him. He says, shouldn't you be doing the same thing for me? Because I am like Blondine. I'm trying to feel my way on this tightrope across the Niagara Falls of Civil War. When another delegation of clergymen from Chicago came to him to say, the will of God is that you should emancipate slaves, his response to them was not to disagree with them. It was to say, if it is the will of God to emancipate slaves, don't you think he would reveal it to me first? Somewhat more strategic position. But then he does also add, if I can discern what the will of God is, I will do it. And you see him speaking over and over again about trying to understand what the best way forward is. Sometimes he does make mistakes. I think one of the most remarkable letters he wrote was to Ulysses Grant after the fall of Vicksburg, to Grant's siege of the Confederate city. And he writes this to Grant, and he says, when you set out on your campaign, I thought it was mistaken. I was thinking then that you should have gone downriver and joined forces with General Banks. And then when you crossed the river, I was anxious because I was afraid you were going to be isolated. But now I have looked back on all of this, and you have been successful in the capture of Vicksburg. And I'm writing this letter to you to say that you were right, and I was wrong, thinking, what president today would do something like that? What president today, what politician today would be interested in making a concession like that? And to one of his subordinates, Ulysses Grant, a man who in 1863, Lincoln could not be entirely sure, might not have political ambitions of his own. Lincoln, in the end of July 1862, writes a letter to a Louisiana Unionist named Cuthbert Bullitt. And in it, he talks about all the criticism and the backbiting and so on like that. And he says to Bullitt, frankly, you people in Louisiana have asked for your own trouble. But then he concludes the letter by saying, I shall do nothing in malice. What we are dealing with is too great for malicious dealing. It's a remarkable statement. He is trying to work his way to a great conclusion, what he calls a great consummation. But he also knows that there's no map. He doesn't have any Google program that will help to guide him. He's trying to feel his way forward. And what he wants people to do is to understand that, be patient, to see how things open up. And he will follow that line if he sees it clearly. So yes, there is what I would call a kind of democratic humility in Lincoln, but he's willing to understand that he does not possess all the wisdom. But he's trying to do as best he can see things. And what he wants people to do is to encourage and support him in that, rather than simply to criticize him for not having pulled a rabbit out of a hat all at once.
I guess, too, and you're familiar with the just mounds and mounds of books about leadership, lessons of Lincoln, and there's you could fill a library just with those things. I guess I wonder then, in hearing you talk about him and reading your book, if a lot of that is in a way almost kind of pointless. It's like saying to somebody, well, just play basketball like Michael Jordan or just sculpt like Michelangelo. I mean, at some point, I wonder if Lincoln was just so different and such I used the word very purposely, such a genius that it's really hard to apply what he did to someone who doesn't have that same political genius. What do you think about that?
Well, it depends on how you understand leadership. There are some people who believe that leadership is a trait, and leadership, therefore, is a mysterious possession that some people are just born with in their DNA. And it's not something that can be learned. It's not something that can be copied. The best you can do is, when studying leadership, to hope that you're going to be in a position where you can recognize it in a genuine leader. But it's not something that you can practice or develop yourself, like batting or pitching. On the other hand, even batting and pitching sometimes seems to be, at its best, produced by people who just somehow have got the right lineup of things, and they just are able to do it in the most natural fashion imaginable. Now, in that way, you have one school of thought about leadership, but you have a countervailing school, which does say, oh, wait a minute, no, leadership can be learned. Leadership is not about some mysterious matter of temperament. Leadership is a series of traits that you can recognize and that you can incorporate and develop in your own life. That's why we've got so many books about leadership. The libraries of them, whole sections at Barnes & Noble, books on leadership, Attila the Hun's Lessons on Leadership. The volume of those books is what makes me suspicious, because if in fact we really did know what those traits were, we should be able to get it down into one or two books and we wouldn't really need a whole shelf of them. The shelf of them itself is a betrayal of the fact that maybe it's not quite that easy. I don't have a way of ascertaining absolutely whether leadership is a matter of temperament that you just born with. It's like Mozart composing. Or whether it's a matter of acquired traits that you can learn from copying others or that you can learn from historical examples. I don't have an answer to that, but I think we can say that there are certain traits of Abraham Lincoln as a leader that it's worth, if not actually incorporating into our own practice, something that we can recognize in other people. One of them I've already mentioned, and that is humility. Humility in the sense of understanding you might not have the answers to everything, nor do you thoroughly and completely understand someone else's motivations, or even the motivations of people who criticize you. Maybe they're right. And democracy thrives in an atmosphere of humility. So when you see the kind of humility I've talked about in Lincoln, yes, that is an aspect, especially of democratic leadership. There's also some other characteristics of Lincoln that I think are worth contemplating, if not downright imitating. One is resilience. A man could absorb a tremendous amount of punishment without responding in a vengeful fashion. In fact, in the largest sense, he absorbs the punishment of the Civil War itself. In his second inaugural, he speaks about how the Civil War has been a judgment of God on the entire nation. But it's from that he's able to draw this moral, and that is to show malice toward none and charity for all. For Lincoln, being able to incorporate that, not to have too thin a skin, that's extremely important, especially for leadership in a democracy. There was a letter that he wrote to a Shakespearean actor, because Lincoln loved the theater. Lincoln loved Shakespeare in particular. He could recite chunks of Shakespeare off by heart. A famous Shakespearean took his attention, a man named James Hackett, and he had Hackett come and actually make a sort of command performance of Shakespearean monologues at the White House. And afterwards, Lincoln wrote him a letter saying, "Well, I've read a number of the Shakespeare plays. There's some I haven't read at all, but there's others I've read over as much as a professional actor. And, you know, here's a few points that I think are interesting about certain monologues." Hackett, alas, took that letter with the best of intentions and published it. And the critics and the press went wild over, "What is the President of the United States doing, wasting his time and the taxpayers' money writing letters about criticism of Shakespeare delivery?" And Hackett wrote to apologize to Lincoln. Lincoln wrote him back and said, "No, don't worry about it. I have gone through life," he said, "I have gone through life encountering a lot of kindness, not entirely free from ridicule. And I've had to deal with a lot of malice, not entirely unmixed with some kindness. I am used to it." That phrase, "I am used to it," I think it says a lot about his resilience. A third trait about Lincoln in terms of leadership is how much he got to know the system. Knowledge of a system is absolutely necessary if you're going to function as a leader. You have to know things from the shop floor up. And Lincoln did. He had served in so many different capacities in government, as a state legislator, as a member of the House of Representatives, and even as president. He has a lot to learn, and he sets himself to learn it. He learns the system. He learns where everything is. He learns how the systems operate. And by midway through his presidency, he's become such a master of the system that his private secretary, John Hay, writes in his diary, I never knew until now, this is the summer of 1863, "I never knew until now how much control Lincoln has over everything. He's running the draft, he's managing the cabinet, he's got this war going, he's doing it all at once. He sits there," Hay said, "like some backwoods Jupiter throwing his thunderbolts." And then Hay added, "None is so good and kind as he. I believe that God has put him in this place." When you bear in mind the old wisdom about no man being a hero to his valet, and when you bear in mind that John Hay was a young whippersnapper out of Brown University when he goes to work for Lincoln, that's the exact opposite of that old wisdom. Hay only got more in awe of Lincoln. And when you see things like that, then you realize that in meeting Lincoln, yes, you're meeting leadership of a very remarkable kind. And those are traits that you want to see in other Democratic leaders. I think it's also traits you want to see if you cannot develop in your own life.
I think of those three traits you mentioned. While I can think of a few modern politicians who may have two of those, the humility one seems to be a stumbling block for an awful lot of political figures, for sure. And that combination is pretty rare.
Michael, not just political ones.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. Toward the end of the book, you argue that the most lasting lesson that we can take from Lincoln and the struggles that he faced during his presidency is that democracies worry too much and too little. And I thought that was just a fascinating line. I was hoping you could explain a little bit what you mean by that.
It's a contrast I borrow from David Runciman in a book that he wrote about how democracies perish. He's that sounds like a very negative title. It's actually, in a lot of ways, a very optimistic book. And it's a book I'm happy to recommend to people. But Runciman said that democracies do this remarkable double flip. They worry too much about crises that aren't really crises. They worry themselves sick about these. They pick at them and they rub them and they concern themselves over much with them, when it turns out that particular issue really is not all that significant. And they're not going to die of it. It's almost like a hypochondriac. But at the same time, democracies miss things that really are crises. They're looking someplace else. They don't see something about to knock them on the head. But Runciman then goes on to say that the great virtue of democracies is that even when they don't see a real threat coming, and the threat does knock them on the head, there is a great resiliency in democracies themselves that authoritarian and totalitarian regimes simply don't possess. Authoritarian and totalitarian regimes look strong. They look powerful. They have parades in Red Square with goose-stepping soldiers and missiles and other kinds of paraphernalia. They look powerful. They look intimidating. But they're really quite fragile. The first time that they hit serious opposition, the first time they hit a brick wall, they go to pieces. And we've seen that happen time and time again with totalitarian regimes in the 20th century. And we'll see it again in the 21st century. They look powerful. They look threatening. In fact, internally, weak. But democracy, you knock democracy down, and democracy looks like it's down for the count, but it never is. Democracy instead scrambles back to its feet, looks around, wonders, what hit me? Oh, yeah, that hit me. Okay, folks, let's get together and do this thing. And the democracies win against every appearance. Democracies have that resilience. They have those qualities that even when they don't see what is palpably a threat, nevertheless, they recover. They have strength that these other regimes do not have. I think Runciman is simply spot on in diagnosing this. So do we worry sometimes over much about things we really don't need to worry about? Are we political hypochondriacs in a democracy? Yes. Yes, I've seen us do that. And sometimes do we not see something that we should have seen? Yes, we do that. And yet, the American democracy has endured. Democracies in other places have endured. Where democracies have failed and faltered, they have done it because of things internal to themselves. They have done things that speak to long cultural deficits and historical problems in their own lives. I do not blame the failures and the falterings on democracy itself. There are some places and some regimes which simply have so much historical lumber from an ugly past that it's hard for them to function in a democratic fashion. But that's not the same as saying that democracies are weak. The contrary, they have tremendous latent strength. Question is, then, for democratic leadership, do we have leaders with the qualities that will allow us to marshal those strengths and take us into combat in whatever situation combat is required? Economic combat, political combat, sometimes in the case of the world wars, quite literal combat, and triumph in it. That is the real challenge of democracy, seeing the difference between what really isn't a threat, but which we fear might be, and what is a threat, but which we do not see as such.
It sounds to me that in the end, you're an optimist when it comes to American democracy, because, of course, nowadays we've had for the last few years all sorts of talks about threats to democracy, and maybe having had spent so much of your time focusing on a period where the threats were literal, real, physical threats, that give you a perspective on this. But am I right about that? Are you, in the end, optimistic that we will get through this period, if not stronger than ever? Certainly, we'll manage to stumble through it in some way or other.
Ultimately, yes. I'm an optimist in the same sense that Lincoln was an optimist. An optimist when he said, as you talked about at the very beginning, that democracy is the most natural form for government, for free people to assume. And if, in fact, we are a free people and prize being a free people, which we are, then I believe that our democracy will, in fact, survive its anxieties and survive its challenges. I believe we will come through. It will take work. It will take voices that help us to distinguish between what is a real threat and what is not. It will take voices that will encourage us, as Lincoln, to think in terms of democratic humility about what we demand of each other. We will see resilience on display. We have survived some great crises as a democracy. We look back on them as elements of history, and therefore we don't necessarily feel them as emergent threats. But reflect for a moment on the election of 1800. That was a violent election. Think also of the elections of 1824 and 1828 with Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams. Those were more moments when it seemed like the whole edifice of democracy was cracking and crumbling. And then, of course, 1860 to 61, we paid a high price for dealing with that threat to democracy at a price of hundreds of thousands of lives. And yet we did survive it. It did not destroy us. And we emerged from it, and we were stronger in the emerging. As I say, it cost a great deal. And one cannot reflect on the costs of that war without a great deal of sorrow. But it is still a sorrow out of which springs a rainbow. And the rainbow is the same promise of democracy that Lincoln discerned, giving those remarks at the cemetery in Gettysburg in November of 1863. It was looking out at the burial site of approximately 3,500 Union dead from the battle. He could have sat upon the ground and told sad tales of futility, of cost, of blood. He did not. He said, "From these honored dead, we take increased devotion." That's a statement of optimism. Increased devotion to the cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. From that, we draw a strength, and a strength that will lead to a new birth of freedom. And we will go on stronger even for this. To that extent, just as Lincoln, yes, fundamentally, was an optimist, even though not a man of optimistic temperament, he would tell people, I'm not one of these glad handers. I'm not one of these people with a sunny disposition. And he wasn't. He was a worrier. Yet at the same time, you can be a worrier and still be a cosmic optimist. In that respect, yes, I am an optimist.
Well, on that note of cosmic optimism, I think it's a great place to close. Alan Gelsel, it's been a delight talking with you today.
Well, thank you, Michael, and thanks to all of the people who tune in with your cast. And I hope that as we look at the image of Lincoln, and I hope as more than a few people might read our ancient faith, that we will ourselves experience that renewed dedication to government of the people, by the people, for the people. In that case, Lincoln is one of our best guides.
Thanks for listening to this Politics Guys interview. If you're not already a supporter of the show, I hope you'll consider becoming one, because without our supporters, we wouldn't be able to do this. And when you become a supporter, you get not just that warm, fuzzy feeling, knowing that you're supporting a good cause. I like to think we're a good cause. But you also get stuff like ad-free versions of everything we put out. You get our supporter-exclusive midweek show, the full length of that, not just the preview. And you also get to be part of our Discord group if you want. And there's always some interesting conversations going on there. At the $10 a month level or more, you get to actually be part of the episodes Jay and I do, if that's something you're interested in. So there's a lot of stuff, is what I am saying, and I hope you'll consider checking it out. And to do that, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you want to support us on Venmo, we're at Politics Guys. You can also support the show through PayPal, and all of our support links are always in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And as always, I want to close with a very special thank you to our wonderful executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.